What are you reading now? And what have you read in the past? How do the things you've read in the past help you better understand what you're reading today? Or in the future, for that matter? And what if it wasn't just what you read, but what you listened to or watched? And hey, what if this could be shared with lots of folks? Welcome to That Reminds Me. This is episode 1F, featuring a conversation between Ashish Kulkarni and Adish Khanna. It was recorded on 8 January 2020. Ashish and Adish talked about Auntie Lee's Delights, a book by Ovidia Yu, about an Infinite Monkey Cage podcast episode about dinosaurs, and about an Our Fake History podcast episode about Niccolo Machiavelli.
Good morning, Adish.
Good morning, Ashish. Good to see you again.
You too. All right. It's been a while since we recorded one of these, but I'm looking forward to this particular episode.
So am I. What are we talking about today?
Three things that I would want to speak to you about. You posted recently about reading a book called Auntie Lee's Delights, written by a lady called Ovidia, if I'm not mistaken.
Ovidia Yu.
Ovidia Yu, yes. That's the first episode that I'll want to speak about. And this very strongly reminds me of a book written about Bombay. And I want to riff a little bit about both cities on the basis of this episode.
Let's do that.
All right. The second one is a bit of a personal favorite of mine in terms of topics. Dinosaurs. This is the Infinite Monkey Cage.
That's fine.
All right. And the third one will be about Machiavelli, about whom I actually don't know all that much. So this episode won't be so much of this particular conversation won't be so much of this reminds me of something rather than help me understand this better. But we'll see how it goes.
All right, let's do that.
Great. Let's begin with Auntie Lee's Delights. Any excuse to talk about food as far as I'm concerned?
For the sake of our listeners, let's let them know that Ovidia Yu, the U is spelled Y-U. And we can now get into the book, which is a murder mystery set in Singapore. And the detective in this case, there are two detectives. There's the actual policeman and there is Auntie Lee, who runs a small restaurant and just a restaurant open for lunch and dinner. And she helps investigate the murder.
Right. Tons of things that this book reminded me of, but let me begin with the one that I'm quite curious about, because there's one book, like I said, about Bombay that I want to speak about. Is Police Commissioner Raja the Hastings to Auntie Lee's Poirot?
No. For starters, I think Auntie Lee is more in the Miss Marple mode than
Poirot mode. Right.
And Hastings was never in the... Hastings was never in the police, and Hastings was quite a bungler. So Hastings' job was there more to narrate and talk about how awesome Poirot was.
Right.
Over here, there is no narrator. The writer herself, Ovidia Yu, is narrating from a point of view of whoever is present.
Mm-hmm.
So we get to see both the policeman and Auntie Lee working independently. And secondly, the blurb is a little out of place. There is a police commissioner Raja, but most of the investigation is being done by Staff Sergeant Salim rather than Police Commissioner Raja. Police Commissioner Raja is just someone who Auntie Lee knows well. So because of she gets to interact with the police much more than any random person off the street would.
All right. So when I was speaking about Hastings and Poirot, I wasn't going for the specifics of being a policeman, but sort of a Watson to Sherlock, Hastings to Poirot, the sidekick angle. Because not typically, but certain murder mysteries tend to work well when there are two guys and there's definitely an alpha and a beta. So I was asking if it's the same kind of setup here.
If you're talking about a sidekick, quantity, her domestic help fulfills that function. Her domestic help is this Filipina former nurse who's come to Singapore to work as a domestic servant, is working sort of illegally as a waitress also for Auntie Lee. and we see Auntie Lee sending her out to do stuff, investigate, gather information and clues when Auntie Lee is too tired to move about herself.
Okay. I was very strongly reminded of when I read your write-up about this particular book, Auntie Lee's Delights, is a book called Murder on Malabar Hill by Sujata Massey. I can't for the life of me remember how I chanced upon that book, but I loved reading that book because it's a, as the title suggests, a murder mystery set near Malabar Hill. But more than the mystery itself, which isn't, as in your case, all that great, it's the fact that I got to learn a lot about Bombay, especially the Bombay of the late 19th and early 20th century, which made me enjoy the book a lot. Did you have a similar experience with this particular book?
Not really. It's not Singapore very far behind.
Okay.
So it's quite similar to the Singapore I'm already used to. I think this book is not more than 9 or 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And apart from that, it, whatever it does say about Singapore seems to be the same stuff you'd get in a tourist guide, and it's not that deep a dive.
Oh, that makes me feel a little bad because I was, if at all I read this book, unlikely, but if I read this book, it'll be more to learn about the society in Singapore than about the murder mystery per se. Quite often, I enjoy reading books not because of what the book speaks about, but to paraphrase Roger Ebert, how the book is about what it is about. So describing the social setting, describing the context in which the story has been set often helps me learn more than the enjoyment of the book itself.
If you'd like to experiment with that, there's another Singapore book I read in the last couple of years, which is a Singaporean time travel schoolgirl mystery, which goes back into the Singapore of the late 1980s. And that does do this close look at the difference between the Singapore of the 80s and the Singapore of the early 2010s or late 2000s. So this is a book called Mount Emily.
Mount Emily.
Yeah.
Done. A note has been made and my ever expanding list of things to read has grown marginally longer.
Again, not a really great book, but if you are looking for quick reads which give you a little bit of insight into different time periods and different places, I recommend it.
All right. Okay. Based on your notes written about this particular book, one thing that we've already touched upon briefly, the fact that Auntie Lee is a Miss Marple, and you say that Auntie Lee is a Chinese Miss Marple. Is the book similar to the theme of Miss Marple? Does she use her past observations to guide her current deductions?
Yes, very much. It's, I think the motif of the Miss Marple stories was always Miss Marple sitting, observing, not gossiping very actively, but always having an eye on the village around her and using that to draw conclusions. Now, Singapore is much more than a village, but Auntie Lee moves in very rich circles, so it does still have that small town feel. And the fact that Auntie Lee is someone who is always putting her nose into other people's business and always taking note of things and judging other people, which would be terrible in someone you actually know and have to hang out with, is turned into a virtue for the purposes of being a detective.
Okay. Miss Marple, and this is this reminding me of Taken to a new dimension altogether, but Miss Marple, I just realized, and Mrs. Bantry, they remind me of Dhritarashtra and Sanjaya. When you said she herself doesn't gossip all that much, it's a weird tangent to draw, but the analogy, at least to me, is quite clear.
Now that you've mentioned it, it's clear to me as well, but let's expand on it for the benefit of our listeners.
I know. The trouble with a conversation such as this is you're tempted to take it into ridiculously tangential directions. But coming back to the notes that you have made, you said one thing which grated is the fact that you get to see the inner thoughts of more than one character. Could you expand on that, please? Especially the pretty inconsistently bit.
Yes. So, the writing advice which is generally given for fiction is if you are a narrator or if you've picked a character to be the narrator, you can, the text can show what the narrator is thinking. The text can show what the narrator thinks other people are thinking, but you don't really get to see the inner thoughts of people who are not the narrator. In Auntie Lee's Delights, Ovidia Yu, the writer, is the narrator. So we get the point of view of multiple characters. We get the point of view of Auntie Lee. We get the point of view of Staff Sergeant Salim. We get the point of view of some of the other characters who are suspects or who are victims. And at all, and in every chapter which is focusing on a particular character, you at times get to see the stream of thought of those characters. So you really see everyone's stream of thought and not just one single narrator's. And it's not like this is done very consistently. In some chapters, this is done a lot more. Some chapters are much more dialogue focused. So that spoiled the reading experience for me, I think.
Okay. The thing that this reminded me of was one of my favorite, and confession, I don't really like Agatha Christie all that much, but the one book that adheres to the rule that you spoke about, and who knows, maybe I enjoy this book for that reason, is The Murder of Roger Ackroyd. It's written entirely in the first person and you're privy only to that particular person's thoughts, not anybody else.
It's been a long time since I read much Agatha Christie, but I think she was reasonably consistent with this rule.
True. Also, another thing I wanted to speak to you about, and maybe listeners will benefit from this. I know I've been tempted to figure out how to get this done myself. You waited a long time to get a library ebook copy. For our listeners, could you quickly speak about what a library ebook copy is and how does one go about getting it?
So, unfortunately, I don't know if there's any way to do this in India.
Right.
However, if you are outside India and a member of your local public library system, you can borrow ebooks along with physical books. If you have a generous friend or family member who is living in the United States, you can ask them for their library login, and if they give it to you, you can set your Kindle to an Amazon US account instead of an Amazon India account and download Kindle copies onto your Kindle with that library membership.
This is one of those want to get it done but will never get around to getting it done kind of thing for me, but it's something I've long been tempted by, because God knows I'll save a fair bit of money by borrowing rather than buying books. Kindle has helped, but God, reading is expensive.
If it's any consolation, in pursuit of doing this money-saving hack, I've ended up buying two extra Kindle or e-reader devices. So the money saved has not been exactly saved.
Yeah. I think for the sake of your happiness and mine, let's quickly skip over buying gadgets as a topic of conversation. You did say that Ovidia uses other books you're not tempted to try on the basis of this one book. One final point about this particular episode before we move on to the next one. Has there been a series where you have persevered and it has ended up being worth your while? Other books in the series, I mean.
With Ovidia Yu or in general?
Other writers where you were tempted to not read further, but you decided you'll give it one more chance and things worked out really well after that.
So I'm not sure if this counts. N.K. Jemisin's Broken Earth trilogy takes some time getting into, but is very rewarding. That's something I can think of which I've read recently.
Okay. The reason I ask is because this point which you spoke about, that you're not tempted to follow through, reminds me of something that I've been researching on for my own blog, the sunk cost fallacy, and how it perhaps might not be a fallacy. Sometimes there is merit in persevering even though it doesn't seem worth your while. So just curious if there has been an episode, whether it is reading or something else, where sticking through the difficult or the boring part has been worth it.
I can think of books where sticking through boring chapters has been worth it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've done enough series in the last 3 or 4 years to remember something all through.
Okay. So it's a point that I've been wondering about increasingly this week in particular. Is a sunk cost really a sunk cost or not? But the topic is surprisingly complicated to think about.
So if I think I've been quite ruthless in regarding sunk costs as sunk costs when it comes to series, and I'm a little more generous when it comes to regarding the first 4 or 5 chapters as something that can possibly be gotten through.
Okay. All right. Moving on to the second episode, if you have nothing further to say about Auntie's Delights, let's hit on Dinosaurs, the Infinite Monkey Cage episode.
Nothing further to say about Auntie's Delights, but just wanted to say that I think I do have The Murders on Malabar Hill lying on my bookshelf, courtesy my wife, but I've not yet picked it up. And now that you mentioned it, I probably will.
Great. I hope you like it. All right. Now, Brian Cox and Robin Ince, you have given the excerpt from the podcast or the blurb for the podcast. They kick off about dinosaurs, a topic that I used to be very interested in at one point of time. Sadly, my reading about this topic has been non-existent for well over a decade now. Before we get talking about the episode itself, the blurb mentions that they're joined by comedian Rufus Hound. Before anything else, I'm curious about why they would want a comedian to speak about this in the first place. Was he interested in dinosaurs growing up, or is this guy somebody who knows a fair bit about dinosaurs even today?
The Infinite Monkey Cage is a BBC show, also released as a podcast, where the format is that a scientist and a comedian interview a panel which consists of two scientists and a comedian. And it's a panel discussion about a topic in science, but where they have two comedians around to keep things light enough for a general audience.
I can't tell you how much I love the concept. I wasn't aware of this. I think I'm going to give this a try.
So, yeah, it has done a lot of very interesting topics, not just dinosaurs. The one I just finished listening to is animal intelligence, and they've done topics like, are human beings still evolving? They've done a topic on the moon landings, which we discussed in an earlier episode.
Right.
So yeah, it's a podcast, and it's pretty fast paced as well. So when we talk about this particular episode, this of course is the context, but when Rufus Hound was interviewed, he said that growing up, he used to work at a museum before he left in disgust.
Okay.
Maybe disgust is not the right word. He left to pursue his comedy career.
Okay. Very quickly, before we begin speaking about the episode proper, you said that there has been an episode about whether human beings are still evolving. This is actually a pet peeve of mine. I often read or listen to people who say that we ought to lose the small toe on our foot, or men ought to evolve away from nipples. And the reason it gets me a little upset is because that's, to me, not how evolution works.
And we can possibly also talk about, we did talk about paleo fantasy last time, so we can refer to that again. But yeah, this is something which biologists call the fallacy, that evolution has to be directed towards a particular aim, and really it's just whatever works in the moment.
Exactly. All right, there's only so long that we can avoid talking about dinosaurs themselves. So let's speak about this particular episode. Would you mind giving our viewers some background about what the episode is about, and then we'll dive into your notes?
Well, the episode is about dinosaurs. They did take a very broad view, wide-ranging view. It's not about any particular aspect of dinosaurs in itself.
Okay. Two things. One, the last sentence in the blurb itself. What are the big questions that dinosaur hunters are hoping to uncover? And did they go extinct at all? I'm guessing the did they go extinct at all is the avian link to modern times.
That's right.
Okay. We'll get into that later, of course. But what are the big questions that dinosaur hunters are hoping to uncover?
So I cannot really remember at this point the big questions that they have uncovered, which were brought up in the episode, are that over the last 5 or 10 years, they have found the color of dinosaurs.
Okay.
And of course, they have discovered dinosaurs in areas where traditionally paleontology or dinosaur research was not happening, and where researchers have now started going and are uncovering many, many more fossils. So China and Mongolia.
Right. Okay. The first thing that I found fascinating about this particular episode was the first bullet point that you had put up about fossil hunters who sell fossils on eBay. And that's where museums end up getting fossils. As an economist, I don't know about you, but this kind of makes me happy.
I don't know if it makes me happy. It does make me very fascinated. And the scientist on the panel, Susanna Maidman, talked a lot about how she was offered an extremely well-preserved fossil on eBay. But then she wanted to actually go and see the site. And to do that, it involved going to the original seller and then tracing back the entire supply chain, which would have been about 6 or 7 people. And this was a fossil from Morocco. So she said she spent many weeks in Morocco just visiting the original eBay supplier, asking him where he had got it, going backwards, and that this involved lots and lots of Moroccan tea.
Which isn't a bad thing at all, given the little Moroccan tea that I've had.
Yeah.
Okay, the reason I said it makes me happy as an economist is because of something that Tyler Cowen would call markets in everything. What is the alternative if this particular mechanism, selling fossils on eBay, did not exist? Would we likely have discovered lesser fossils without this arrangement? Is the part as an economist that makes me happy.
Well, going by what Susanna Maidman has said, very likely, because had this fossil not been offered, she would not have been able to carry out her dig and do the more careful, more scientifically driven fossil dig, having first found the original one.
True. All right. The second point was about a whole bunch of kids, and we are old enough to qualify for the second bullet point, who saw Jurassic Park in 1993 and ended up surging into paleontology. Now, neither of us actually ended up going into paleontology, but the point is a very well-made one.
Yeah, and I think it's not just about paleontology. There would be so many things which at the time seem either frivolous or pure entertainment or some form of outrage, which is all sound and fury and no light. But 10 years later on, you realize that this has actually triggered something very big. So I was reading earlier in 2019 a book by N.K. Jemisin, which is a collection of short stories called When Do We Get African Future Month? I think the name is similar to that. We link it. And it's a collection of short stories, but it closes with her essay on how from 2002 to about 2007, there was a major move among blogs where not writers, but fans of science fiction, and particularly African-American or Asian or third world fans of science fiction would write very impassioned, very long, very frequent blog posts about how the science fiction books that were getting published were by white authors, by male authors, and how the points of view of the fans were not getting represented in what got published at all. And this was one of the early outrages, pre-Twitter outrages. It was called Race Pail. And the point which N.K. Jemisin makes is that it took 10 to 15 years for these fans to get together on the back of this initial blogging to get picked up by writers groups, get picked up by publishers, and that suddenly the kind of authors who are getting published by science fiction houses is much vaster and much more diverse than it used to be. So yeah, it took 10 to 15 years for that. And similarly, Jurassic Park touched off a surge in interest in dinosaurs, which took 10 to 15 years or maybe 20 years to have its impact on kids going into paleontology programs at college, kids going into paleontology research, and now a point where we are discovering 50 new species of dinosaurs a year.
Yes, that's a point that I want to get to. The econometrician in me, I'm slightly horrified to note that the fever is increasing within me, is interested to find out, say, for example, there was an increase in enrollment in astrophysics, say, about 10 to 12 years after ET was released, and so on and so forth. But it might be an interesting bit of research to do.
And this might be one of those things where movie makers or bookmakers piling onto a hit and trying to do their own or trying to do their copycat movie or copycat book actually keeps fueling that surge and keeping it fresh.
Yep. My final point about this, and I don't know if it's true or not, but I can't help but wonder now and do a little bit of digging on this. Friends came out in the year 1994, if I remember correctly, and who knows, maybe Ross Geller was a paleontologist because of Jurassic Park.
I have no information about this, but it would be fascinating to find out.
Yep. All right, next bullet point. 50 new species of dinosaurs being discovered a year. This reminds me very strongly of A Short History of Nearly Everything by Bill Bryson and the impassioned debates that Bill Bryson speaks about in that book about how to classify a species. Apparently, people come nearly to blows on the basis of a Linnaean system of classification.
To go on.
So, when you discover a new species, is it actually new species? Is it just a variant, a subspecies? And how do you decide? And the whole science of taxonomy is an especially fascinating one. So, I wonder if it actually is 50 new species, or is it 49 or 51, and how they go about deciding it?
This is not something the panel went into.
Okay.
But I feel that even if these aren't 50 new species and they are just 25 new species in which there's a wide variety of forms even within a species, the fact that a single species can have a variation in how it looks, how much it grows, is also quite fascinating.
True, true. All right. In fact, one thing that I wanted to speak about in this regard, and I'm skipping forward a little bit, but did Brontosaurus or did Brontosauri exist? Is the Pluto a planet of paleontology is a somewhat fascinating point. What's the controversy here?
So, ever since 1903, there has been arguments among paleontologists about whether Brontosaurus is a genus or a species in its own right, or whether a Brontosaurus is just a smaller or a larger Apatosaurus. So, when you were talking about Bill Bryson discussing scientists coming to clashes over whether a species is independent or whether it's a subspecies or how to classify a particular either live specimen or a fossil,
Right.
Brontosaurus and Apatosaurus are part of that.
Okay. All right. I was guessing as much.
And this apparently in paleontological circles caused as much angst and fury as whether Pluto is a planet, a dwarf planet, or not a planet at all.
Yes, of course. I think Bill Bryson speaks about that as well, but it's even now a fair source of controversy. In fact, my daughter in her school, I'm not sure if she learns about Pluto as a separate planet or not. Is it a planet? Yeah.
Pluto was a planet once.
So Adi, she'll be glad to know that she's been taught in school that Pluto was a planet, but now it no longer is considered a planet. That's what the latest education system's ruling is.
Well, that's good to know. I think it joins interesting things like were we once Indian citizens and are we no longer Indian citizens once the documentation is no longer available?
I don't think it's going to be a separate episode. That deserves a separate series in its own right, and one that I would be very interested in being a part of.
Yeah, we can skip your doorbell and move on to the next point, or do we have something more to talk about dinosaurs?
No, we'll skip both the doorbell and dinosaurs for the minute, and let's move on to Machiavelli.
Yes, let's.
All right, so when it comes to Machiavelli, first things first, obviously I've heard of Machiavelli. I haven't read The Prince, neither have I read much about Niccolo Machiavelli, so I actually don't know all too much about Machiavelli.
Sure. So in the English-speaking world, Machiavellian behavior refers to the ends justifying the means. The other famous quote associated with Machiavelli is, "It's better to be feared than to be loved." And all in all, Machiavellian in popular English usage is now a synonym for very manipulative behavior, very ruthless behavior, lots of cruelty and no empathy. And this particular episode of Our Fake History goes into the question of to what extent are those stereotypes true of both Machiavelli's writing and Machiavelli's personal history as a person?
Okay, I'm actually tempted to begin with the very last point about the prince being satire, is something that you mentioned in this, I think has been discussed in this particular episode. The reason this is fascinating is because of whether there are multiple interpretations of Machiavelli from a Straussian viewpoint, and whether there are layers or ways in which it needs to be read, given the context, given the history, given his political leanings.
So the host of this podcast, Sebastian Major, says that while people over the years, including Strauss and including Jean-Jacques Rousseau, have come up with various different interpretations of the prince, including that it's a joke, including that it's actually a trap meant to force tyrants into counterproductive ways of behavior, that it's a job application, that it's an elaborate piece of flattery. The simplest explanation is that the prince is entirely sincere, but that its reputation for encouraging ruthless behavior is highly overstated.
Okay. So another point that I wanted to speak to you about, and this may end up being a little bit of a controversy, but I'm not so sure Vivek Dahejia has actually done a dramatic volte-face. So the context for our listeners is, I'll just read out the point that Adish has written. If the teaser dangled about Machiavelli writing The Prince against his own ideals, but to get back into the good graces of the new Medici regime is true, it sounds a lot like the Vivek Dahejia, Rupa Subramaniam household's dramatic volte-face over the last 7 or 8 years. I'm not sure what you mean in this case, that he was against the new regime, then became pro and then became anti. Is that what you're getting at? Specifically where Dahejia is concerned.
Where Dahejia is concerned, I think the major flip-flop has been on demonetization, where he started out with saying, yeah, it's not that bad, or it's actually an idea with extremely good intentions, and he later slipped into, no, it was actually a terrible idea.
Oh, my apologies then. I wasn't aware of the fact that he had changed sides and is now thinking about demonetization as a bad idea. So I remember reading a piece written by him, and I think it was Jagdish Bhagwati, in which, as you say, they say that is a really good idea. I wasn't aware that he's now gone back on that earlier stance.
All right, so I think we cleared that point up.
But in the larger point of this reminds me of about not just specifically Vivek Dahejia and Rupa Subramaniam, but about how much of history it really is a large point about history being written largely by the victors, but how much of history that we read today, not just where the Machiavelli episode is concerned, but I can think of quite a few others. Are we reading the version that has been sanitized over time by the people who won? And is there really maybe multiple histories lurking under the surface?
Let's address the Machiavelli specific history
sure.
first, and then we can
sure.
go to the larger point.
Yep.
The context for this is that Machiavelli was a member of the government of Florence when Florence used to be a republic.
Okay.
There was subsequently, through a war, the grandson of Lorenzo de' Medici, Lorenzo the Magnificent, who is also named Lorenzo de' Medici, comes back and effectively becomes the tyrant of Florence, and the old republic is lost. And Florence now becomes a tyranny or a kingdom or a dictatorship, as you choose to call it. And because Machiavelli was so identified with the old regime, he was kicked out of government, put in prison, tortured. And it was at this point that he wrote The Prince. So one of the interpretations of The Prince is that The Prince is just this elaborate piece of flattery towards the new King of Florence, wherein Machiavelli has written an entire book just to say that everything which Lorenzo de' Medici, the younger Lorenzo de' Medici, is doing as Prince of Florence is exactly what he should be doing. And
I know, as I said, I know very little about this, but on the basis of what you said so far, I think there may be a bit of both things going on right now. Maybe a bit of satire, but also a bit of self-preservation, along with underlying principles that Machiavelli truly happened to believe in. Sounds way more complicated than can maybe be unpacked in one particular episode.
Machiavelli has written two books. The first is The Prince, and this is what has given Machiavelli his terrible reputation and made Machiavellian a synonym for ruthless.
Right.
The other book is called The Discourses on Livy. Mm-hmm. It's the history of the Republic of Rome. And The Discourses on Livy is a book where Machiavelli keeps saying over and over again that the best form of government is a republic.
Okay.
And The Discourses on Livy is what Machiavelli wrote earlier, while he was, I think, either in the government of the Republic of Florence or when this revolution had happened and the Republic of Florence had been overthrown. So we are presented with two books by Machiavelli, one in which he just says over and over again repeatedly that the best form of government is a republic, governments which are in the hands of a single monarch are inferior to republics, etc., etc. And then some years later, we get The Prince, in which there is this elaborate guidebook on how a prince should behave or how a monarch should behave, and which says nothing at all about republics.
Okay. So before we get back to Machiavelli, there is maybe merit in doing a separate episode just on the other book that the guy wrote. So Machiavelli and Adam Smith are two prime candidates in my opinion, and I'm sure given what you have read of Adam Smith, you'd agree.
So a point the podcast host makes, and and he makes it only about Machiavelli, but I believe it would be true of Adam Smith as well, mm-hmm. is that everyone talks about them, but no one has read the source material.
Right. I'm happy to say, at least in Adam Smith's case, in my personal case, that is not true. But Machiavelli, not only have I not read The Prince, I'm only discovering today that he'd written another book as well.
And again, I haven't read The Wealth of Nations either. Fortunately, I have read The Theory of Moral Sentiments. I am somewhat qualified to talk about Adam Smith, but I have very far from having completed the full works.
True. Okay. Coming back to Machiavelli, like I said, based on what you've told me, and I'm learning more than thinking about tangential references right now, but based on what you've told me, the story is way more complex than just painting him as a somewhat evil quasi-politician-like guy who speaks about principles. The story is much more nuanced. And the key takeaway for me is I want to read much more, not about the prince per se, but first maybe a decent biography of Machiavelli himself.
Sounds good.
Final point before I think we'll wrap this episode up. Pete Marlowe's play, The Jew of Malta. I haven't heard of the play. Could you speak a little bit about it?
Even what I explain will be a paraphrase of what came up in the podcast episode. But Kit Marlowe is someone who was a contemporary of Shakespeare. And we know and we have encountered him every once in a while in popular culture where Shakespeare pops up. So in Shakespeare in Love, we see Christopher Marlowe early on in the movie, where he's shown as a much more successful playwright than Shakespeare, who is at that point a struggling playwright. And later on, we get to know that Christopher Marlowe has been killed in a brawl in a bar. But yeah, okay. Christopher Marlowe was one of the major playwrights of that era before Shakespeare became Shakespeare.
All right. Okay, my key takeaway, especially from the third episode, has been to read as much about Machiavelli as possible before attempting to tackle The Prince. But seems like a way more fascinating personality than I would have thought otherwise, which is in and of itself making this episode worthwhile, hopefully for me and also for the listeners.
So again, once you get out of the English-speaking world where Machiavellian has become the synonym for ruthless, in Italy itself, Machiavelli is seen as one of the founders of modernity and one of the founders of political science and an overall great guy and intellectual.
Yep.
And I think once you get out of mainstream discourse and into political science professors as a circle, this would be a viewpoint that's repeated.
Excellent. My new learning for the day. All right. I can't think of a better note on which to wrap this particular episode up. Adish, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ashish. Let's do this again soon.
Absolutely. Look forward to it. See you.
You've been listening to That Reminds Me, Episode 1F. Today's conversation was between Ashish Kulkarni and Adish Khanna. Ashish's blog is econforeverybody.com and Adish's blog is adish.net. That Reminds Me is a podcast produced by Ashish Kulkarni and Adish Khanna. You can find all episodes of this podcast at thatreminds.me, where you can leave your comments. You can also email us. Our address is feedback@thatreminds.me. The podcast is supported in part by a grant from Emergent Ventures. The show music is The Carnival of the Animals, performed by the Seattle Youth Symphony, courtesy of Musopen at musopen.org.